This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. A well-managed modern immigration system is fundamental to maintaining U.S. national security. Whether it is the changing demographics of its customers, fluctuating and unpredictable demand for immigration services, or the rise of new security threats, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services seeks to respond effectively to strengthen the security and integrity of the nation's immigration system. How is USCIS enhancing its outreach and becoming more customer-centric? What is USCIS doing to ensure the integrity of the U.S. immigration system? And how is USCIS taking the immigration system into the 21st century? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Alejandro Mayorkas, Director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Ali, welcome to the show. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael.
Let's start off by learning more about the mission of CIS. Would you give us an overview of its mission and evolution, and how does it support the overall mission of DHS?
I appreciate the question. Our agency was created as part of the Department of Homeland Security following the Homeland Security Act of 2002, and it stems from the Legacy Immigration and Naturalization Service, or INS. And our portfolio is really the administration of our country's legal immigration system. And so we extend benefits to those who are deserving. We welcome and embrace people who are eligible for our nation's immigration benefits and really continue our nation's proud tradition as a nation of immigrants. We also have the responsibility of ensuring the integrity of the system that we administer and safeguarding our national security. And it is in those latter regards that we fit into the Department of Homeland Security's overarching mission of securing our homeland.
So could you give us a sense of the scale of operation? How is USCIS organized? What is the size of its budgets? The split between fee revenues and appropriation and the number of employees?
Sure. Our agency consists of about 11,000 full-time federal workers, and we also have a rather significant contractor workforce that we use when our needs require greater nimbleness of employment. Our budget is in excess of just about $2.4 billion. And what many people don't realize is that our primary source of funding is actually the fees that we receive from individuals who apply for immigration benefits. That is the predominant source of funding that we receive. We receive about $260 million in appropriated funds of the $2.4 billion in our budget. So, for example, one of the appropriations is directed to our Office of Citizenship, which is dedicated to educating people on the rights and responsibilities of citizenship and promoting immigrant integration. That is an office within our agency that is funded predominantly through appropriations.
What about your role, now that you give us a sense of the larger organization? What is the official responsibilities of the director of CIS?
I am the leader of the agency, and so in that regard, I represent the agency in public, and I help steer the course of the agency. Let me say that because of my style of management, I would describe myself as the chief collaborator, because I believe in leadership through collaboration and through teamwork. We have a remarkable leadership team within U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and so I am a member of that team.
So regarding your responsibilities as chief collaborator, what are the top three challenges you have faced in your position, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
We have faced a number of challenges recently. I would say in the last a year or two. One of them, of course, is financial challenges. In the difficult economic times, we've seen our revenues slip considerably. And as a result of being a fee-for-services agency and in a climate when it is very difficult, and understandably so, to receive an increase in appropriated funds by virtue of the condition of our nation's budget, it's very difficult to pass on cost increases in a declining revenue environment to our customers, because they too are suffering from a difficult economy, and a significant percentage of our population is not able to pay higher fees. So I would describe our financial challenges as one. I would also say that we as an agency have not necessarily been as uniform or consistent as we should be in our administration of the immigration laws and regulations that guide us. We have seen different policies crop up, if you will, in different parts of the country or different parts of the world, despite the fact that we administer a single set of laws and regulations. And that is one of the concerns that I've heard articulated quite vigorously by the communities we serve. And so we've been seeking to address that very vigorously.
So what about you? I'd like to turn the focus on learning a little bit more about you and your career. Would you describe your career path to our listeners? And how did you begin your career, and what brought you to your current role?
Thank you, Michael. I began my career as a lawyer. I started off in private practice, and really had a desire to join public service early in my career, and I had the opportunity, I should say the privilege, of doing so. In 1989, I joined the United States Attorney's Office for the Central District of California as an assistant United States attorney, a federal prosecutor. And I developed a specialization in the prosecution of white-collar crime. And after approximately 8.5 years as an assistant U.S. attorney, I was very fortunate to be selected by Senator Feinstein for recommendation to the president to be appointed as the United States attorney for that same office. And in fact, I served in the Clinton administration as the United States attorney for just under 3 years. I then rejoined private practice as a lawyer. I led then-President-elect Obama's transition team in the criminal justice arena for the Department of Justice. And I have always had a keen interest and some experience with our immigration laws. I myself am a refugee from Cuba. My parents, my sister, and I fled communist Cuba in 1960. And so the issue of immigration is one that has been very close to me personally. I also dealt with immigration crimes as a prosecutor and therefore had professional experience with it as well. And I was very drawn to the mission of our agency.
You mentioned earlier the idea of leading by being the chief collaborator. And given your experiences, what are the characteristics of an effective leader in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? And who has shaped your leadership style?
Michael, let me say this. I think the obligation of and opportunity for a leader is to bring out the best in the people with whom the leader works. That is the key, and to provide opportunities to individuals to ensure that their potential is being maximized. I think that is the core responsibility of a leader, and really to enable the agency to play to its strengths and to work on its challenges. I can think of many individuals who have shaped my approach to leadership, but let me just mention my father, because growing up, I learned in watching my father to ensure that egalitarianism and how you treat people as individuals and as equal individuals is a core principle not only of leadership, not only of a professional, but as a person. And I would say that is the overriding ethic that has shaped me.
How is USCIS enhancing its outreach and becoming more customer-centric? We will ask Alejandro Mayorkas, Director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? How is the Navy strengthening its information dominance for the 21st century? What is the U.S. Postal Service doing to reduce its carbon footprint and green its operations? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Alejandro Mayorkas, Director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Alec, would you elaborate on the guiding principles that frame and inform the strategic vision you've outlined to improve operations and outcomes for your agency in the 21st century?
Michael, I shaped the guiding principles based upon my communications with the workforce when I first arrived and with the communities that we serve through speaking with them in public forum. And let me articulate them. I think one we've touched upon already, and so I'll mention it first, and that is consistency. Our workforce deserves consistency, and the communities that we serve deserve consistency, and that is something that we need to achieve. It is not necessarily our greatest strength currently, but we are certainly devoted to achieving it. Efficiency is a second principle, and I identify them, Michael, in no particular order. But efficiency is something that is incumbent upon us as a public service agency. We have customers, and therefore it is customer service. But there's also another principle at issue, why it is so important that we be efficient, because we spend customers' money, and we therefore have to be very careful in how we spend our money. And let me, if I can, share with you an anecdote that I have shared with colleagues within the agency and at times with members of the public that has really been very influential in my care for the dollars that we spend. I remember visiting my great aunt and uncle in Brooklyn when they were quite elderly, and they came with us from Cuba to the United States. And I remember being served a sandwich wrapped in wax paper. I'm not sure whether sandwiches are any longer wrapped in wax paper, but be that as it may, I remember enjoying the sandwich and afterwards crumpling up the wax paper and being prepared to throw it away. And my great aunt took the piece of wax paper, looked at me with tremendous disdain, and took that piece of wax paper and unfolded it and tried to the best of her ability to uncrease it. And what I saw was a carefully cut square of wax paper, which my great aunt then took and placed on top of a stack of wax paper squares on top of the refrigerator. Because she was a former seamstress, her husband, my great uncle, was a former machinist, and they relied on their pension from their union work for their living. And it is the nickel that was saved through that wax paper square that is the nickel that we spend as an agency, because my great aunt and uncle were immigrants, as was I and my family. And so that image is very emblazoned on my mind in terms of our cost sensitivity as an agency, and efficiency serves cost sensitivities. Integrity is, of course, another core value, another core guiding principle. It is not only the integrity of our immigration system, in other words, protecting the integrity of the system from those who seek to exploit it, because I think those exploitative efforts injure those innocently coming before us seeking benefits for which they are eligible. But it also speaks, of course, to the integrity of our workforce. We are guardians of the public trust, and therefore integrity is of critical importance. And the fourth is transparency. The president has articulated a vision from the moment he set foot in office of open government. And we serve the public, and we have to be held accountable to the public. And to that end, we have to be transparent in the information that we provide and in how we conduct our business and why.
Well, actually, picking up on that part of engaging the citizens or customers that you serve, would you elaborate on your technical efforts to make your agency more customer-centric? And what tools are you leveraging to enhance the interaction between your agency and the customers you serve?
It's a very important question. It speaks of the difficulty of our work in terms of customer service, because our customer base is extremely diverse, not only in terms of countries of origin, not only in terms of diversity in that sense, but also in terms of level of sophistication and level of representation. You know, one of our principles, of course, is equal access. And we have individuals who come before us who are dealing with sophisticated immigration benefits in the high-skilled labor arena, who are represented by very sophisticated and capable counsel. And we are also serving the indigent, who do not have anybody by their side necessarily, and who do not have the facility with the complex laws and regulations that we administer. And we serve them all equally. And we have to therefore develop customer service tools for each constituent in that broad spectrum of a customer base. And that is a challenge. We have early on in my tenure, we redesigned our website to make it more customer friendly. We made it available, the redesigned customer website. We redesigned and made it available in Spanish and English. We provided individuals with an ability to track the progress of their cases, to even receive text messages when an update occurred. We are now working on a modernization program that is going to move us from a paper-based system to an electronic environment, which is going to yield tremendous benefits to our customers and to our workforce. We are looking at ways. We have an 800 line where individuals answer very basic questions. We are looking at how we can take that 800 line, that toll-free number line, and actually alter it to address the more sophisticated that have case-specific questions and the like. We're really spending a great deal of focus and energy in this area.
Well, as a follow-up, would you tell us about how you're improving your stakeholder engagement programs? And more particularly, what prompted you to establish the Office of Public Engagement, and what's been accomplished to date?
That, I think, is one of our crowning achievements to date. And it serves open government, but it also serves good government. I don't believe in a public service agency of governing exclusively by edict. In other words, addressing a particular area of immigration law and developing a policy and publishing that policy and learning whether, in fact, it is correct or not, whether it captures the law, the intent of the law most ably, through the reactions of our customers and through the reactions of our operations. Why don't we collaborate with the public we serve? Why don't we draw upon the expertise of the public that we serve and the experience of the public that we serve in developing our policies and our procedures? Why don't we just open ourselves up? And so the Office of Public Engagement was created not as an office of communication, but as an office of engagement. And so what I did early on was I went out into the public and I asked them, what questions did you need answered by us? What concerns do you have with respect to how we do our work in the service of you? What issues do you have? And we embarked upon a series, an ongoing, continuing series of conversations and engagements on subjects of importance to us as an agency and to the community as the public that we serve. And we learn from that, and we develop protocols to serve that spirit of engagement and that reality of engagement. So, for example, now what we do, unless there's a fraud detection or national security reason why we wouldn't, is we engage with the public on a particular subject. We go back and we formulate a policy informed by that engagement, and we post for public comment our policy in draft form. We give the public an opportunity to comment on it, and we do not own what is right ourselves. We can benefit from the best thinking that resides not only within our agency, but also within the public. And through that collaborative effort, through that engaged effort, we come and should come to policies that are better informed, more responsive, and truer to the spirit of the laws and the regulations that we enforce. So, for example, I learned early on that we did not have a very transparent or consistent method of administering fee waivers, the ability for individuals who cannot afford the fees to have them waived. In fact, we didn't have a form that guided that process. And so through that collaborative effort that I described, we developed the first ever fee waiver form. And we've done things like that. I'm proud to say we have a lot of first evers as a result of that engagement process, and it's really been terrific.
Well, you mentioned earlier that one of your guiding principles is consistency of policy, application, interpretation of immigration laws. So I'd like to talk about what are you doing to ensure that the policies are consistently applied across the agency, and what key lessons have been learned and applied as a result of your top-down policy review operational guidance?
Michael, there are two issues with respect to consistency. One is, and you mentioned one of them importantly, which is to ensure that our policies are consistently applied. There is also a first step, which is to ensure that our policies themselves are actually consistent from one office to the next. And we haven't found that always to be the case. And so what we did was we started the policy review. We gathered together all of our adjudication policies throughout the agency, and we decided that we need to go in serial fashion through those policies to ensure that they are consistent, that there is one policy under a particular legal principle or regulation, and that it is that one policy that guides all of our adjudications throughout the country, unless there is a reasoned basis for having a divergence. And it is a Herculean effort because we have many, many, many policies. Some of them are very complex. In deciding the priority of our review, we asked our workforce and we asked the public, in what priority should we proceed? Really touching upon my principle of engagement and not governing by edict. Our workforce may be clamoring for consistency in a particular area more acutely than in other areas, and we want to be responsive to our workforce just as we are responsive to the public. We issued a survey, and we received over 8,000 responses to our survey, and we developed our priorities accordingly. And so we are executing on that policy review. The challenge is, quite frankly, the speed with which we need to execute. We are not moving at the clip that we need to really accomplish this task, which is multi-year in duration, but to accomplish it at a pace that best serves our workforce and our community.
Well, speaking about the workforce, would you elaborate on your strategy to create and cultivate a culture of excellence and performance at USCIS?
I think that a culture of excellence and performance is all about giving our workforce the tools that they need. And there are two avenues. One is training and one is professional development. And let me share with you my view of the distinction between the two. Training, I think, is equipping an individual to do the job the individual currently has. Professional development is giving the individual the opportunity through tools and otherwise to perform the job the individual wants to have in the future, to grow and to excel as that individual's talent warrants and dictates. And I've devoted a considerable amount of resources and both financial and personnel resources to both training and professional development. We have a new chief of training who is outstanding and a new head of our training academy. We owe it to our workforce, which is our greatest strength and greatest value, to deliver to them what they need and what they want.
So you had touched on one of your major challenges was the realities of fee revenues and the fact that they've gone down. So given the budget realities of today, what are you doing to implement some cost-cutting measures that will improve operational efficiency and reduce cost? And how does the establishment of a new umbrella management organization within your agency factor into these efforts?
The new management directorate, Michael, we created as part of a realignment of our agency. I came in and felt that there were certain areas that we needed to enhance our focus upon and, frankly, to raise their profile within and outside the agency. And so I created a management directorate that oversaw a number of management or administrative functions which are of critical importance. Human resources, it's all about human capital. Chief financial officer and various other enterprises in that realm. In 2010, we cut our budget by approximately $186 million in an effort to ensure that we were being as careful and frugal as possible with the way that we spend our money. Unfortunately, we had to cut into muscle a bit. And that was because, as I mentioned earlier, our fee revenue had dropped. And the choice before us was to raise fees and to raise fees in a tough economy with a customer base, many of whom can ill afford the current fee structure, was something that I worked very hard to avoid. I could not avoid it entirely, but I certainly was able to minimize it. And so we went through our agency top to bottom, each directorate, which is an operational entity within our agency, each program office, and we made difficult, sometimes accessible, sometimes less accessible budget cuts to be careful and responsive to the fiscal environment.
How is USCIS taking the immigration system into the 21st century? We will ask Alejandro Mayorkas, Director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How is the federal government leveraging award prizes to spur innovation and solve tough problems? Pick up the latest Senate report, Managing Innovation Prizes in Government, and find out. Drawing on such successful efforts like the Lunar Lander Challenge and DARPA's Grand Urban Challenges, this report offers practical insights and recommendations for the design, implementation, and evaluation of innovation prizes in government. You can order or download a free copy of Managing Innovation Prizes in Government and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org. Telework has been touted as a winning strategy for government. In fact, a study by the Telework Research Network claims potential savings of nearly $3.8 billion. In a recent IBM Center report, Implementing Telework, Lessons Learned for Four Federal Agencies, Professor Scott Obermeyer presents case studies of federal agencies who have successfully implemented telework in their organizations. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Alejandro Mayorkas, Director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. What is your agency doing to integrate new immigrants into U.S. communities, and how do you ensure that these integration programs are actually delivering on investment?
Michael, we have an Office of Citizenship that is devoted to the integration of immigrants lawfully here in the United States as one of its core missions. And in 2009, we created and executed the first ever immigrant integration grant program. We distributed $1.2 million to 13 organizations throughout the country to assist them, community-based organizations, to assist them in developing programs for the integration of immigrants in their respective communities. And it was very, very successful. And with the leadership of the president and the support of Congress, the bipartisan support of Congress, we were able last year, through a greater appropriation, we were able to administer just over $7 million in grants to many more organizations around the country that provide direct services to immigrants to assist them in integrating into our communities, and also to help certain organizations build capacity. And we are executing on that same grant program this year. And we have metrics for success in terms of number of immigrants reached, the influence of the outreach on the immigrants in terms of the tools available to them to really become integrated members of our community. And we have a very significant feedback stream, and the support that we've received for this grant program has been extraordinary.
Well, I'd like to transition to your efforts, which are currently underway, to build an immigration service for the 21st century. And you alluded to the enterprise-wide modernization effort you're engaged in. What is this effort? And more particularly, how does it seek to enhance national security, customer service, and operational efficiency for your agency?
Michael, we are a paper-based system. So if you were to walk into one of our facilities that stores files, the concluding image of the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie of all of those crates in one office might come to mind. And so we embarked a number of years ago on an effort, a modernization effort that was termed transformation, because it really is transforming our agency from a paper-based system to an electronic environment. And it will allow our customers to access us through computer rather than the actual submission of completed paperwork. And the efficiencies gained by that are obvious from a processing perspective. But there's also successes that are to be achieved through that modernization in our efforts to combat fraud and help safeguard our national security. Because in the electronic environment, we have the ability that we don't have to that level now of cross-referencing information, of watching trends, of seeing what is submitted in one file and what is submitted in another, and perhaps drawing connections from an investigative or analytical perspective. And so really, that is our future. And we have a great team on that as well.
I'd like to transition a little bit to another system, and that is the E-Verify system. What are you doing to optimize its performance, improve its ease of use, and expand or enhance its capabilities, such as giving it the capability to identify identity theft?
So the E-Verify system, which is designed to enable employers to ensure the lawfulness of their workforce, has been increasing in accuracy exponentially these past few years. And as a matter of fact, more than 98% of the time, it identifies as work authorized an individual who is, in fact, work authorized. Where it is not as successful is in the area that you identify, which is in its ability to capture identity fraud. It was not intended to do so. It was intended to be able to establish as work authorized an individual who is in fact work authorized. And as I mentioned, it's been remarkable in that regard. But we were making incredible improvements in its ability to combat identity fraud. So, for example, last year we included in our database, or we introduced into our database, a passport photographs. And so through the use of photographic matching, we've made a step in our effort to address identity fraud. Identity fraud is something that E-Verify plays a part in. E-Verify is one tool in the government's toolbox or arsenal to address identity fraud. And there are other tools that are owned by other agencies that do that as well. But we are really focused on that because of frankly, its occurrence and our need to be able to address it more effectively.
Well, you've sought focus on greater emphasis of program integrity and national security issues. And to that end, would you tell us how you've realigned organizational structure to eliminate fraud, identify national security threats, foster that information sharing or info sharing you were just referring to? And how does the establishment of the Fraud Detection National Security Directorate factor into this?
Michael, when I came on board and I did a top-to-bottom review of the agency, as I said I would, I saw that our fraud detection and national security portfolio was embedded in an operational directorate that had a wide spectrum of responsibilities. And I did not think that was properly prioritizing our fraud detection and national security responsibilities. And so I created a directorate, which is really an operational component within our agency devoted exclusively to our fraud detection and national security responsibilities. I made it a freestanding directorate. And it cannot be overstated the importance of and benefit of having a fraud detection national security leader around the leadership table. Because so many of our issues are inextricably intertwined with other issues and implicate fraud issues or national security issues, or fraud issues and national security issues implicate other operational issues and policies and the like. And so it was of vital importance to have someone from that portfolio exclusively at the leadership table, and we've gained tremendous, I think, leadership input and value from that. And it's a core responsibility of ours. The nation deserves it and requires it. And frankly, it serves not only in ensuring that people who seek to abuse our system, or worse yet, do us harm, are not able to avail themselves of benefits which they do not deserve, but it also enables us to more effectively be open and embracing to those who do.
What does the future hold for the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services? We will ask its director, Alejandro Mayorkas, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. This is the Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness, brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level. Joining us on the Center This Week is our very special guest, Rafael Boras, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Rafael, welcome.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
So with an important mission, a varied mission, and a huge operational footprint, let me talk a little bit about what you do as the Undersecretary for Management for DHS. Could you give us a sense of the role and the responsibilities you have under your purview?
Probably the simplest way to describe it is the Undersecretary for Management is the Chief Management Officer for the agency. So what does that mean? In addition to all of the financial apparatus, the human capital apparatus, so it's the CIO, the CX, all the Chief Financial Officer, the Chief Procurement Officer, all of those administrative authorities report to the Undersecretary of Management. But I really think about my job as being sort of the number one steward for good government. Really, that's what I see my job is, to constantly talk about good business practices, good return on investment. Now, somebody's going to say, what investments in the federal government? Well, we make investments in people. We make investments in goods and services that we acquire. So it's my job to make sure that we're good stewards of those investments, of the taxpayers' money. So I'm always talking about good government. I think that's my job.
Rafael, it's a great segue into understanding. You've alluded to it a little bit about the need to serve as an element, I would say, of leadership. But I want to get a sense of your definition. What are the characteristics of an effective leader? And who, if anyone, has influenced your leadership style and management approach?
Well, you know, there were so many individuals along the way, wonderful men and women that were mentors, both officially and unofficially, some who I work for and some from afar. And I took away so much from all of them. You know, I'll give you a very simple story. During college, I was working for my father. And my father had a business associate who was in a relatively comparable line of business as my father. And he walked into my father's business one day and he said, I acquired a dozen crates of batteries. And I'm going to sell these batteries. And they're a great deal. And I'm going to make all this extra money off these batteries. And he had this conversation with my father and he left. And my father said, he's going to wind up eating those batteries. And I had to be about 17 years old at the time. I said, Dad, I don't understand. What do you mean? He says, he's lost sight of what his business was. He just took advantage of this opportunity, took batteries in, and thought he was going to get in the battery business. And I predict he's going to wind up eating these batteries. Well, lo and behold, about a year later, my father got a call. This fellow was going out of business. And because he was in a related business to my father, he said, oh, you might want to come over and take a look at, you know, maybe there's some things that I've got that you can use. So my father asked me to go with him. And we looked at some of the tools, some of the merchandise that was my father didn't have any interest in. He took me into the back and he said, I want you to look at something. What do you see in front of you? And I stood staring at all these boxes and it didn't hit me right away. And my father said, there are all the batteries. Case after case after case of batteries. You know, as simple as that sound, it was such an important lesson that I learned about, A, understanding your core business and staying to your core business. And I use that a lot for myself to make sure that I'm not getting myself into batteries.
Raphael, what are you doing to drive results, outcomes, transparency, and accountability in your organization?
Well, we've been going through an exhaustive process. And I say exhaustive. Coming on the heels of the QHSR and the BRRRR, it was important to begin to turn our attention, our management attention, to what are the indices that we will measure to be able to showcase to the American people that we are indeed fulfilling what we stated in the QHSR and what we identified as priorities in the BRRRR. So we've been going through this very exhaustive process to develop performance measures that are realistic, that are reflective of the true mission of the department. This has been something that the Secretary, Secretary Napolitano, has been really, really pushing us to do. And I've got to give tremendous kudos to our Deputy Secretary for really helping drive this process. So we're literally going top to bottom through all of our performance measures. We've thrown out a whole bunch of them. We've come up with new ones. But it's forcing every component, every service delivery part of DHS to take a look at what is their core mission, how do they plan to do it, and how do you measure that? How do we know that we're delivering what we've said we're going to do? And you think about such a varied mission, whether it's the Coast Guard, how do we know that the Coast Guard is doing all it can, and how do you measure their effectiveness in search and rescue, for example, or in FEMA after an incident? How do we know that FEMA is actually doing a good job? Well, we got to understand what their job is first. There was a lot of issues surrounding Katrina and other events like that. We've learned a lot about what is the role of the federal government, how do we work with our state and local partners, and then force us to think, okay, how do we determine, how do we measure that effectiveness? How do we know we're doing a good job? How do we know we're doing a good job in aviation security? What is a good job for a job well done for a transportation security officer on the line, for example? You know, how do you look at that? How do you measure that? You know, these are the things that we've been working very hard for the last couple of months, and we have to complete that process. OMB has to review that. It's, again, a requirement internally before we can disseminate them. But I think the department has shown a lot of creativity, a lot of innovation, and really a determination to rethink how we should talk about what we do and then, therefore, how we measure that.
Let's talk about the consolidation of the physical department with the DHS headquarters consolidation project. Would you tell us more about that? What are the benefits and operational efficiencies that will be realized from the move to a one physical infrastructure?
Well, there's so many areas that just make good sense about consolidating the department's headquarters. First of all, we're spread out at about 50 different locations within the National Capital Region here in Washington, D.C. So from efficiency standpoint, from a communication standpoint, from a collaboration standpoint, there are just so many inherent inefficiencies with that model. Now, we didn't get there by plan. Again, remember, this organization was put together by bringing together organizations that had their own locations or had their own leases outside of physical headquarters location, and many of these are long-term leases. So this has to be staged very carefully. This is a managed process to bring these 50 locations together. And we're very fortunate to be able to have the campus, the West Campus of the St. Elizabeth's Hospital site available for the Department of Homeland Security. So working with GSA to utilize that space, preserve the integrity, the historical nature of that campus, but also allow it to meet our operational needs, is a wonderful activity which forces us to confront this one DHS. What are we? Is it simply being in one place? If that's all it was, that would be easy. Just move everybody into the same building. Does that guarantee success? Does that guarantee the one DHS? Of course not. It's not about the physical location. It's about the process we undertake to understand our mission, our interdependencies, and how do we use this new facility to reestablish, to sort of relocate and rethink about what does it mean now to staff the Department of Homeland Security? What does it mean for the way you provide human capital services? So if you have multiple entities going to St. Elizabeth's, for example, do they need multiple offices of human capital? Can we do that with fewer human capital offices serving the campus? Same thing with financial management or acquisition. So going through this exercise forces us to look at ourselves, see how we're structured, how we're organized. The physical part, the physical assets are just really the vehicle that is forcing us to address these issues.
What's the status of the project? And more particularly, I'd really like to tackle this part. What are some of the critical challenges you've faced in moving?
Well, any kind of physical relocation is a massive undertaking. You know, some of the biggest challenges initially, and again, many of my predecessors faced this, was establishing the rationale for doing this. I don't want to sort of diminish that. Making the case that this was important to bring the department together was made by some very good people, and they did a good job of it, and Congress has supported that. I have nothing but great respect and admiration for the hard work that was done to build a platform that said, this is something that is a good investment of taxpayer money, and we're going to fund this. And that's sort of step one. Secondly, is coming to grips with, as I alluded to earlier, what is it, how are we going to use that space? And then how are we going to physically downsize, if you will, from 50 different locations into something substantially less? So you've got all the issues associated with different leases, staggered times, different cost structures, different overhead rates, and you've got to bring all of that together. This is a tremendous learning opportunity for the organization to learn how to do this. So in addition to the physical location, co-location, in addition to all of the efficiencies or synergies that we can develop, the discipline of going through this process is going to be very helpful. Now, how's the project going? You know, as a construction project, it's going very, very well. We're on time. We're on schedule right now. We continue to enjoy wonderful support from the Congress and from OMB that see great value in this project. Well, we expect to be done in around 2013, and it'll certainly take the better part of a year to physically move all of the people and all of the assets into the new Coast Guard building.
Well, you've mentioned before as one of your key challenges, well, actually two of your key challenges is acquisition and human capital. You've also touched on the fact that enhancing processes and structures or physical or centralizing a physical location is just not enough. You have to have the right people with the right expertise in the right job. So I want to sort of bring this all together and get a sense of, would you elaborate on your efforts to build a cadre of acquisition professionals at DHS?
First of all, I like the word acquisition because it's much more broad. It's much more broad and much more expansive than just procurement. Typically, when we talk about acquisition, a lot of people talk about acquisition, they mean procurement. We mean acquisition. So we're looking at just not contracting officers and contracting office technical representatives. We're talking about the whole human capital life cycle that supports acquisition. These are the project managers. These are the cost engineers. These are the schedulers. These are the systems engineers. This is the total asset inventory that's required to support a good acquisition. These are the good program executives that get an opportunity, have an opportunity to conjure up these good acquisitions, these strategies. It takes a whole life cycle, and we're putting our efforts. So we're looking at, what are the right skill sets that we need? What is the right kind of training that's needed to grow the acquisition workforce? Acquisition right now is one of the hottest commodities in the workplace. It's the most, one of the most, if not the most competitive human capital field right now. It's very difficult. We're all chasing the same small assets. So we have to be very creative about growing our own. It's very, very important, very helpful for us to retain our existing workforce. We have to resource them. We've got to train them. We've got to give them the opportunity to grow. But again, what did I say at the outset? If they want to get better, they got to get good first. So we're going to push them to get really good at what they do. And doing so, I think we'll have a much better workforce.
So as our last question, I often ask my guests, what advice would you give someone who is interested in a career in public service?
It's the best career. People come into the public service for all kinds of different reasons. A lot of people ask me, why did I come back into public service? And I really answer it by, how could I not? How could I pass up an opportunity both to serve my country, to practice my craft, to do it in a place that arguably, to me anyway, has the most important mission of all the civilian agencies in the federal government? It's almost like a calling. It's so important. There are trade-offs between going into either the nonprofit, the for-profit, or the public sector. But I think it starts with wanting to do it. You know, I'm here because I want to do it. So I say to the young people quite often, in addition to, you know, if you want to get better, you got to get good first. I always say to them at the outset, you have to want to. You know, in Spanish, we say you have to have ganas. You have to have that desire. If you don't have it, you can't manufacture it.
Rafael, that's terrific advice. I want to thank you for joining us today. But more importantly, I'd like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the invitation to be here. I enjoyed it immensely.
For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been The Center This Week. The Open Government Directive called upon each federal agency to formulate a plan for how it intended to increase openness and public engagement in its programs and operations. The latest Center report, An Open Government Implementation Model, Moving to Increase Public Engagement, provides a roadmap federal agencies can use to guide their efforts. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. The U.S. workplace is undergoing a significant transition that presents uncharted territory and tremendous opportunity. The latest Center report, Engaging a Multi-Generational Workforce, Practical Advice for Government Managers, examines six trends now occurring in the workplace and describes how leaders can successfully manage through these trends and their challenges. These are the challenges of leading a multi-generational workforce and is increasingly driven by rapid technological changes that have changed the nature of work and how it gets done. You can order or download a free copy of this report and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Alejandro Mayorkas, Director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Well, I have the pleasure of talking to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies and the private sector to achieve mission results. How are you leveraging partnerships to improve management operations and program results?
Michael, I've tried to achieve an unprecedented level of openness with the workforce. I have tried to do so with the public, as I've described, take that very same approach with our partners within government, because we have very often shared responsibilities, shared opportunities, and it is only through a partnership